All right, Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning scripture study, and I'm very excited to be here with you today. I pray that all of you are safe and healthy and that you're doing everything in your power to remain that way. I wanted to go on record again, as I've done over the last several weeks, and say that United Israel World Union has some really wonderful people in leadership within our organization, and we have for a very long time. But one thing that we don't claim is to be medical or scientific experts. So we refer our friends and followers to go with the local authorities and to follow the things that are put out by the experts. What we tend to focus on, aside from that, aside from referring you to those people who know the best about situations like we're dealing, we tend to refer to the scriptures because it's where we would think that that our specialty, if we have any, is really around the Hebrew Bible. So I wanted to kind of put that out at first. Now, this week, my studies took me on a lot of different trails. I spent a lot of time in study and meditation and prayer thinking about, as I do every week, what is the best message for my friends at United Israel World Union this week. And given the situation that the world finds itself in, one of the things that I spent some time on are various unpleasantries mentioned in Scripture in various ways, such as disease and consumption and fever and epidemic, plague, pestilence. You know, we are leading up to the festival of Pesach, of Passover. And there are quite a few times that we deal with plagues, not only there, but throughout the biblical text. And so these are just a few of the names or words that I wrote down on my dry erase board early in the week. In other words, every week, you know, as I pray and think and study, I take notes that eventually form into what I present on Saturday morning. So my dry erase board might have looked a little intimidating for anyone who would come into the building this week, though thankfully no one did. On the board, I had those words, disease, epidemic, pandemic, pestilence, and so forth, along with not only the English, but the Hebrew word that I was associating with each of those words. As a result of my studies this week, dealing with all of those unpleasant topics, I stumbled upon, is the only way I can describe it, a field of study that I didn't even know existed. I guess maybe I've read articles that were associated with this field of study at points throughout my years of study, but it's called paleopathology, and that is a science wherein the pathologist is studying or seeking to understand ancient disease in modern times, and some of you may have come across this. I know I had, but I just didn't know what these people were called. A paleopathologist is one who sometimes they'll study mummies, and they'll determine that King so-and-so or Pharaoh so-and-so suffered from this particular disease. Here's how we know that. They're studying the body looking for evidence of that, but they also study written evidence. Not only biblical texts, but other ancient texts from the ancient Near East and literally all over the world. And what they're trying to do is determine with whatever degree of certainty they can these ancient diseases and explain them in modern times. Now, there are quite a few pitfalls, as you might imagine, because we oftentimes don't know exactly what we're looking at because the ancient author didn't use terms that we would be familiar with. Now, this latter piece of what a paleopathologist does, the written evidence, really interested me, and I spent some time in the Anchor Bible Dictionary and reading various ancient sources about ancient disease and pestilence and so forth. And so I felt like I was more qualified in that field since I have no training in mummies and such. Now, I know some of you might be thinking that this doesn't sound like a very interesting class. What I'm doing is I'm building up to where I eventually ended up this morning. So, again, I read quite a bit about paleopathology. Now, one thing that we're dealing with that I want to make sure that I make clear is that the biblical text, the Hebrew Bible, and all of these ancient bodies of literature are what we would term pre-scientific. In other words, they're using language that they're familiar with, and it doesn't exactly correlate with terms and phrases in our scientific understanding today. So we have to be careful, and we have to recognize that that's what we're dealing with. But having said that, the biblical text does present some correlation if we know what we're looking for. I'll give you an example of how we shouldn't read the text too literally and take things in such a way where we're looking at something from our scientific understanding, reading a text and applying something that shouldn't be applied. We're coming up on Pesach. And Pharaoh, we know, had a condition. It's called a hardening of the heart. Now, there are quite a few texts in the Hebrew Bible, as you know, in that narrative. Exodus chapter 4, verse 21. Exodus chapter 7, verse 3, just to name a couple. It talks about how Pharaoh had a hard heart. Now, this is not talking, and I'm making a little bit of light, but just to make the point, this is not talking about coronary arteriosclerosis, a hardening of the arteries in the heart. This is talking about a condition that we'll get into more as we approach Passover that is specifically a resoluteness on the part of Pharaoh to stand his ground. And we'll talk more about that in future studies. But a lot of people say, well, how's that fair? God hardened his heart. He didn't have a choice. Well, I think people make that wrong assumption because they don't read the text closely. Pharaoh resolved himself, hardened his heart, and then God caused him to make that resolve even more so. In other words, you want to be hard-hearted about it? I'm going to give you the full strength to carry that out. But you see the point. The hardening of Pharaoh's heart is not a medical condition. But there are texts that are mentioned in the scripture that I think do give us some correlation between the ancient people and how they dealt with these things and we deal with these things. So one might rightly deduce that some of the diseases mentioned in the biblical text and in biblical times are similar to the present. In particular, this week, as I studied and prayed, I was really searching for answers. And what made it more difficult is that I wasn't exactly sure what question I was asking. But I wanted to assemble some information and gather in some information about the ancient world dealing with pestilence and plague and how that might relate A, to the current situation we find ourselves in, and B, to the Torah reading. Now, meanwhile, in the midst of all of that, as a man of faith, and many of you are people of faith, I've been in prayer. And I've been in a sincere prayer over the coronavirus. And last week I announced on Shabbat that every day we would set up this time where we would all come together and cry out. And that was the class last week, an appeal to people of faith. And you know, I saw on the YouTube channel and in various other places, I get emails where people say things such as, well, how do I know that the person I'm praying with believes exactly like I do, and they were very critical, this particular person. Look, I got news for you. If this particular person is waiting on everybody to agree with him, chances are that's never going to happen. And based on the approach that this person took, I hope that very few people do agree with him. What I'm calling out to is people of faith who aren't so arrogant, but they're humble, and they want to call out to the one true God to help all of humanity, not just their little small pocket of people with their little simple understanding of who God is, and it always aligns up with their thinking. What I'm talking about is people of faith. Look, I'm not checking people at the door for your theology. If you believe in the one God of Israel and that God answers prayer, I'm asking people to come together and pray. So I was participating in that, and several other people were participating in that with me, and I really appreciate that. Look, I got last week a friend of mine messaged me a PDF of a prayer that was put out by a Rav Yitzhak Yosef from Israel. And this particular rabbi wrote a prayer that was a call for prayer for the cessation of coronavirus. In other words, he wanted to stop coronavirus in its tracks. Now, I know that people that are not of faith are going to rely simply on the scientific side of things. And I encourage people of faith to do that as well. But when you're talking to people of faith, we have an extra weapon. We should do the things that the scientific community are advising. We have an extra weapon, and that is our faith. That is our belief that the God of all creation can and does move on behalf of the words of his people. And so in this prayer, one of the things that I saw that really hit me was that Rabbi Rav Yitzhak Yosef quoted Psalm 106:30. I want you to go with me this morning to Psalm 106:30. By the way, welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining me this morning. Psalm 106:30. Actually, we'll begin in verse 29. Thus they provoked him, speaking about Jehovah, to anger with their deeds, and the plague broke out upon them. Then stood up Pinchas and executed judgment, and so the plague was stayed. Now, this particular passage, I just read it from the Koran Hebrew Bible. And this particular passage is, it's very interesting to me because it says, V'yamod Pinchas v'yafalel. He stood, or Pinchas stationed himself, and palal is the root word of pray. It's this idea, you've heard tefillah. It's this idea that one would intercede or to call out. And because of what Pinchas did, look at the next verse, and that was counted to him for righteousness to all generations forevermore. Now, this particular psalm, Psalm 106, and the reference to Pinchas standing and calling out to God for the cessation of a plague was the perfect passage that this rabbi incorporated into his prayer, and it really began to make a bridge for me to build a class on, because like many of you, I've been thinking nonstop and praying and reading and watching news reports and reading reports on the coronavirus. I was studying about plagues and pestilence. I believe in prayer and had asked others to join me in prayer. And then this passage really began to make me think deeply. And I believe it was part of what inspired me for the class today. So this particular reference in Psalm 106 would point us back to. We're not going to read it today, but the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, I almost combined the Hebrew and the English and said Namidbar, Numbers and Bamidbar, chapter 25, verses 10 through 13. Now, this got me looking at Numbers 25, 10 through 13, and the word that was used for plague there. Now, the word for plague has a root that means to strike or to be stricken, and at its very basic meaning, it deals with contact. To strike or to contact. Now, there is another common word that's translated throughout the Hebrew Bible as plague and pestilence, and it means to touch or to strike. But notice these words, touch, strike, contact, have to deal with something coming in contact with something else. That made me think that these ancient writers might be aware that at times there was a contagion in their midst. Now, remember now, we're talking about pre-scientific documents. We're talking about pre-scientific texts. What we didn't know in the ancient world, or what they didn't know in the ancient world, is all of the insights that we now have on the spread of infection and contagion and so forth. But what they began to notice, basically, from what I can tell, is that whenever a plague hit, it was transferred from one person to the next through touch, through contact. Now, some people may not buy into what I'm selling, but I'm telling you, I believe that this is the case, that when something would pass through, a plague, a pestilence, would pass through, as it were, the camp, that it was being communicated or it was communicable through the touch. Now, having that thought in mind and looking again at some of these terms that were written all over my dry erase board, more importantly, in my mind, was this idea because of Rav Yitzhak Yosef's appeal to Psalm 106:30, a question began to raise up in me. Could, in our modern scientific world, could people of faith station themselves and call out to the one God and a plague would be restrained? And I thought, why not? Again, remember now, I started this talk with do what the experts are telling you. Practice social distancing. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. All of those things. But in addition, do people of faith have another weapon when it comes to combating infection, contagion, pestilence, and plague? My answer to that is that I believe that that is the case. Science has provided us with great advances in our understanding of infection and transmission of disease. And in its own scientific, in its own pre-scientific way, the Bible tends to agree. As I've pointed out in previous classes, we have all the makings for the best possible outcomes in a pestilence or a plague based on pre-scientific descriptions. You have your quarantine and so forth. You know, we've covered that at length. Now, one of the things that I wanted to say was, throughout the week, I had quite a bit of time. I know some of you did as well. And by the way, if we have anybody out here who is listening who is really going through a difficult time because of whether that's you're just concerned, you're worried, you have family members who are sick, or you're worried that they might be sick, or if, God forbid, you have lost hours of work or you've lost your job, my prayers really are during the week for you as well, and I want you to reach out. if you need special prayer, because look, we need to work together as best we can. We might have some resources at United Israel in terms of helping you get in touch with the right people. Don't go this alone. Even though you're isolated, we don't want you to feel alone. So reach out to me if that's the case. Don't do this by yourself. Now, with everything that I had going on this week, I also jumped into the weekly tour portion. The weekly tour portion, this week we begin in Leviticus. And so I opened up my Torah, and I prayed as always before I study the Torah portion. Thanks to one of my teachers, Johnny Powell. He showed me a long time ago his favorite verse, and it's become one of the most important verses in my study life, because I always say it, Psalm 119:18. In Hebrew, it's Gale nai va'avita nifla'ot mitoratecha. Open my eyes, and I will look for wonderful things from your Torah. So I prayed that. And I began a study of the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. Now, I've admitted this, and I have no qualms with telling you that Leviticus is not my favorite book of the Bible. I don't know that it's my least, but it's certainly not my favorite. Although, having said that, Leviticus has some of the most important passages in all of ancient literature, and it contains some of my favorite verses. But the book Leviticus, as it's commonly known in English, the name derives from this idea that it pertains to the Levites. Now, the people who came up with this name obviously may have not been able to distinguish between the Kohanim and the Leviim, the priest and the Levites. What they were actually reading was Torat Kohanim, the instructions for the priest. In fact, the Levites are only mentioned three times in Leviticus 25. So the name isn't quite right, but you get the point. Leviticus is full of priestly instructions. That's exactly what the most ancient title of the book was called, Torat Kohanim, according to rabbinic sources. We know it now by the first significant word in the opening sentence, Vayikra, and he called. Now, the reason that I and others have difficulty relating to Leviticus is because, by and large, it seems, stick with me here, it seems hardly applicable today. It seems legalistic, ritualistic, archaic, in places superstitious, and it's just difficult in our modern world to connect with the book when the majority of the book deals with what scholars call at the foot of Sinai. So if you begin in Exodus 25 through the end of the book of Bamidbar, through the end of the book of Numbers, you're dealing with the time that the children of Israel spent, or at least through Numbers 25, you're dealing with a section of texts which deal with the children of Israel at the foot of Sinai. And it deals primarily with the happenings or the goings-on in the tabernacle, the Mishkan, the Mikdash. Now, over the years, I have studied Vayikra, Leviticus, many, many times. I've taught many classes on it, and as a result, I have a very thick file on Leviticus. And each week, usually when I would teach through the Torah portion, I would pray about it, and I would try to pull out of each Torah portion something and relate it as best I could, put handles on it, if you will, so that this ancient text would be applicable. Because truly, if you look past the ancient narrative. Actually, it contains little narrative. It's mostly speeches. Of the 27 chapters in Leviticus, there are only about two or three narrative portions in there. But if you can look past all of the ancient setting, you can derive some very beneficial principles. Principles that we can apply even today. Now, one of the other things that I did, I flipped through quickly years and years of notes that I had taken as I study annually through Vayikra, especially the first portion of the book. And then I remembered that I had recently received a book by a friend of mine, Rabbi Moshe Smokin, who sent me a commentary on Leviticus by Milgram. And this particular Leviticus commentary, when I received it, I just put it on the shelf. And I really didn't read it, but I pulled it down about midweek, and I read through the relevant chapters that I was working on. And nothing really jumped out at me, to be honest. It's a good commentary. But my class, I was still thinking about Pinchas and standing and praying. And so I decided to read the Torah portion again. This time to read it carefully in Hebrew with a blank page. I put all my notes up. I put all the commentaries up. I simply prayed, Gale naiva avita niflaot mitorah teka, and I opened up Leviticus. And as I worked through, one word began to really stand out. And what I mean by that is, this particular word stood out because of the prevalence of its use. A word that occurs 80 times in the Tanakh, 40 times in Leviticus, 38 times in Numbers, 2 times in Ezekiel, and nowhere else. Let me hit that one more time. 80 times in the Bible, 40 of which are in Leviticus, 38 are in Numbers, 2 in Ezekiel, and nowhere else. Furthermore, of the 80 times in the Hebrew Bible, of the 40 times, of the 78 times in the Torah, 25 occurrences of the word occur in this week's Torah portion. So you ready for it? Because whatever this word was, it jumped off the page at me. And I couldn't help but to notice it because it showed up so frequently. The word, as you might imagine if you've studied this Torah portion, is korban. Korban. A korban is translated as offering. Now, you might be thinking, how is this going to connect with pestilence and disease and all of these other things that Ross has mentioned so far? Stay with me and you'll see how it all develops into a coherent class. Korban is a term that's translated offering. It is in some ways a generic term for sacrifice. In fact, one of the academic sources that I read this week says that korban is the commonest and vaguest expression for sacrifice. The commonest and vaguest term, expression for sacrifice. Now, within this particular Torah portion of Vayikra, we have five different types of quote-unquote sacrifices. But the word that really stands out, and I have other classes, I'm sure John Baruch Perry can reference those in links for you, as he does every week, and you can go back and listen to other classes I've taught on Torah reading Vayikra, where I got into those different types and specifics of each. But what I really want to focus on today is the root word of korban. Because this common, the commonest and vaguest term for sacrifice began to shed light on something very important that I want to share with you today. The root word of korban is karav, kof, resh, bet. And as a verb, these three letters, as a verb, mean to come near, to approach, to come near and approach. Now, the same three root letters as a noun, if you look at kof, resh, bet as a noun, kerev, it means inward parts and midst. So the midst. So I have two ideas based on the root. One is to come near and approach. The other, the nounal form, means inner. Inner. Now, if something is inside of you, that is as near as you can get to it. So I want to talk about the idea of nearness and develop that into a class today. The commentators, the scholars, the sages tend to associate the korban as something which draws near, i.e., draws near a person to the one true God. So what we're talking about when we talk about a korban, it's that which draws near. And I couldn't help but think that the other meaning associated with that three-letter root, kerev, which means inner or in the midst of, I couldn't help but think to draw near to God involves something has to take place with the inner person. In other words, we're going to develop this more fully as we work through. But if a person simply follows the external mode of religion, you know, the outside obedience, they're not going to draw near. They may make an attempt to draw near, but it will not be successful because what is needed is an inner change in order to draw near. As I like to say, to draw near to God is an inside job. But I carefully worked through the reading. I carefully worked through noting each occurrence. And 14 of the 25, remember I told you that korban, this generic, common, vague term for sacrifice, korban, occurs 25 times in this Torah portion, in five chapters of Leviticus. So if you think about it, whenever I would read it, I would notice that 14 of these passages utilize, in association with korban, a verb which also has the same root of kof resh bet. Now, let me make some sense of that. In your English, it might say to offer an offering or to bring near an offering. A lot of times the word offering is the word korban, but the word for bring near or offer is also a form of kof resh bet. So you're basically saying the English tries to bring it across as offer an offering, but really what you're doing is you're bringing near the thing that's brought near. Does that make sense? So Hebrew is very descriptive. What a korban is that which is brought near. It's a generic, vague, common term for something that is brought near to God. Let me give you a couple of examples. If you go with me to Leviticus chapter 1, and again, I found 14 of these, which I won't burden you with the whole group of these. But you could do a study. You could look up korban and look at every one. Here you go. So here is the way that the Koran translates Leviticus 1:1-2. And Jehovah called to Moshe and spoke to him out of the tent of meeting, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, if any man of you bring an offering to the Lord of the cattle, shall you bring your offering of the herd, of the flock. Now, in Hebrew, where it says, if any of you bring an offering, ki yakriv korban. Ki yakriv. You'll notice that if you look at the Hebrew, some of you study Hebrew, that's translating, if you bring, ki yakriv. Yakriv has the kof resh bet. So in other words, if any of you bring near that which is brought near. That's the idea. And this happens over and over and over again. So my point being that as I studied the Torah portion in Hebrew, the three letters that jumped off the page are Kof, Resh, Beit, Krav, or Kerev, to draw near and inside. The whole point, this is what I began to write down in my notes, the whole point of everything in biblical faith is to restore a nearness between God and man. Now, if you think about from the very beginning, we get the story of the Garden of Eden. In Gan Eden, we have this beautiful paradisic picture of man in communion with God. There's an image that's so beautiful where it says that Jehovah is walking in the spirit or the wind of the day. You remember the story. Adam and Eve are in the garden, and there is this idea of an intimacy, a place where God and man are together. In fact, we'll look at that in just a minute. But what happens is because of sin, man is chased out of that paradise, what we call paradise lost. And from that point and throughout the biblical text and throughout world history, man has been seeking to go back into a place of communion with God, and that's expressed in various ways in biblical literature. But then we get the story of Cain and Abel. And Cain talks about, it's the first mention of a phrase that occurs over and over in Hebrew Bible more than 30 times. It's called the hiding of the face. It indicates a separation, a distancing, a social distancing between God and man. Now, how is it that God and man are ever going to come back together? Throughout the biblical text, we get clues as to what it is that can begin to ease that distancing and draw us near. So I wanted to make the point at this point that presently, not only are people separated, not only is there what we're calling social distancing, but there is spatial distancing between mankind and his God. There is a distance between us. And I want to talk a little bit about that today. The idea, by the way, or I should say the ideal, is mentioned in Exodus chapter 25. Go with me to Exodus chapter 25. Exodus 25, verse 8 and 9. And it says, and let them, Jehovah speaking, let them make for me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst, that I may dwell in their midst. According to all that I show you, the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all of its vessels, even so shall you make it. So the ideal that God wants to create with the tabernacle is a place, a mikdash, which means what is holy, a holy place wherein Jehovah, the creator of heaven and earth and the God of the people of Israel, can dwell in the midst of his people, right? But there's a distance between us at this time. a distance that is felt. I want to read you a few Psalms. Go with me. Let's look at the Psalms. The Psalms are one of the most powerful in terms of conveying the feeling of being separated from God by some of these writers. Go with me to Psalm 10. I'm just going to read through a few of them. Psalm 10, verse 1. Why standest thou far off, O Lord, Jehovah? Why hidest thou thyself in times of trouble? See this idea, why do you stand off? Now look at Psalm 22, 11, or verse 12 in Hebrew. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. You can feel it. The writer is in agony and pain because of a distance created between them and God. Look at Psalm 35, Psalm 35 and verse 22. O Jehovah, be not far from me, rouse thyself and awake to my judgment, to my cause, my God and my Lord. 38, 21, Psalm 38, 21. I just want to go through several of these passages to talk about the distancing between humanity and God and what I think Scripture tells us can cause that distance to close and for this distancing that's been required to be eased up. Look at 38:21. Forsake me not, O Jehovah, O my God, be not far from me. Make haste to help me, O Lord, my salvation. And there are several other psalms. But the psalmist is trying to say, you can look up on your own Psalm 71:12 as well. But there are others. The idea is that when we feel separated from God, that is a very difficult time. When we feel isolated and alone, remember, the first thing Scripture tells us that is not good, Genesis chapter 2, is for man to be alone. So when mankind feels alone, it brings about all other sorts of issues. So my question becomes, how is it that we, people who claim to be the faithful ones, the saints, if you will, the holy ones of the Most High, people who call out to God and seek to serve Him, how is it that we now can draw near to God? Because if you only have Leviticus and Numbers, if we only had Vayikra and Bamidbar, if we could only read Leviticus and Numbers, we would be in a bad place. Now, what do I mean by that? Don't get offended. Here's what I mean by that. In Leviticus and Numbers, the way to draw near was through a korban, through an offering. Now, remember, the book of Leviticus has one way to draw near to God. But there's a lot of other books in the Bible. But over and over and over, Leviticus and Numbers says that we draw near through sacrifice. But listen to me. There are no sacrifices right now. Now, I know a lot of people say, well, speedy be the day when the temple is rebuilt and we can offer sacrifices. That's not my view, but if that's your view, it's okay. But for right now, we're all in the same place. There is no sacrificial system in operation. There must be another way then. There is no way that the God of all creation gave us a hopeless situation where we cannot draw near unto Him. Now, I want you to go with me to the book of Deuteronomy. Now, remember, Deuteronomy doesn't mention a single time the word korban, sacrifice. Now, but what does it say? And I want you to go with me to Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 4, verse 7. Deuteronomy 4, 7. For what nation is there so great that has God so near to them as Jehovah our God is in all things that we call upon him for? What nation is so great? Now, this particular passage really hit me because one of the things that it says, now remember, I know that there are a lot of other passages which say, return to me and I'll return to you, and that can be related to my study today, but it's a different Hebrew word. It's shuv. I'm not talking about shuv. I'm talking about the one word, kof resh beit, to draw near. So there are all these ideas that people are probably thinking about. But what I began to search for in Scripture was specifically, if we don't have korban or korbanot, how then are God's people supposed to draw near? How are they supposed to karav or karuv, as the case may be, to be near? Deuteronomy 4:7 says that this particular God is near to them when they call upon him. This is what I want to develop. To call out, to cry out, is the method whereby, according to Deuteronomy 4:7, a people draw near to God, and there's no mention whatsoever of a korban. Now look, throughout the text. So then what I wanted to do was I began to do a study on the word calling out. I wanted to get an idea of calling out. So the other thing that I did, remember, this is what I do. I mean, I'm up here full time. So I read a book on biblical prayer, and my idea was calling out, crying out to God, and prayer. I wanted to look at every biblical prayer. So one of the things that I'm working on now, and I hope to teach this in the coming days and weeks, is this idea. I've called it, this study, Teach Me to Pray. Teach Me to Pray. Because I studied this week every biblical prayer. Every time, every passage in all the Hebrew Scriptures where a person called out to God, and I even noted whether God answered or whether the prayer was answered, what Hebrew words are used. Because what I wanted to do is, you know, as a student, I want to see, are there patterns? And it turns out that there is. There is a specific pattern that people followed in the biblical text, and it's quite instructive. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to look. So one of the things that stood out for me as I studied was that this phrase, call out. So Deuteronomy 4:7 says that if we call upon God, he's near. So I looked up every reference in the Hebrew Bible to calling out to the one true God. Remember, and I'll just hit a couple of these quickly, but in Genesis chapter 4, verse 26, it says, then men began to call upon the name. The patriarchs, over and over, it says that they called upon the name. Genesis chapter 12, verse 8, chapter 13, verse 4, chapter 21, verse 33, it says that Abraham built there an altar and called upon the name of Jehovah. So there are plenty of examples. Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 18, he has this showdown, if you will, with the prophets of Baal. And one of the things that he says is, you build you an altar, I'll build me an altar, you call out to your God and I'll call out to my God. So this idea of calling out to God and the subsequent demonstrative action on the part of God to demonstrate that he is there, he is near, this is what I was studying. Now, I wanted to read a couple of passages for you just on the idea of calling out to God, because it is something which goes beyond the Israelites. In other words, this is for global. This is for everybody. Let me open up my Hebrew Bible. Hebrew Bible here because I want to be able to look at the Hebrew and the English. I want you to go with me to the book of Joel, chapter 2, and verse 32. Or in the Hebrew, it's chapter 3, verse 5. Chapter 3, verse 5. And it says, let's see, I've got to find it in the English here. Verse 27. Okay, I'm looking for it in the Hebrew. Okay. And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of Jehovah shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be those that escape, as Jehovah has said, and among the remnant those whom Jehovah doth call. Now, this particular passage, it's going to come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of Jehovah shall be delivered. Now, that, as many of you know, is not the way it's typically understood by some religious groups, but the Hebrew Bible makes it very clear that there's coming a time when all who call upon the name, the divine name, Yehovah, will be saved. Now look with me to the prophet Zephaniah, chapter 3, Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 9. For then I will turn the people to a pure language, that they may all call upon the name of Jehovah to serve him with one consent. The idea, again, just like it was in Joel, that all people, the languages of the people will be converted to a single lip. Probably, I believe that this is talking about Hebrew. I think that all the people on the earth will speak Hebrew. I think that it was the original language, like Isaac Moseson puts forward, what he calls Eden speak. I think it's the language of God and the tongue of angels. And I think that ultimately the curse from the Tower of Babel will be reversed, and all the people of the earth will be of one language for a purpose that's stated here in Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9, and that is to call upon the one true God. Now, go with me to Psalm 116. Psalm 116. And this particular psalm, I love it. It begins, I love Jehovah because he hears my voice and my supplication. He's inclined his ear to me. So this particular psalm, I encourage all of you to read the whole psalm because it was one of the psalms that I pulled out in my study on prayer. And he's describing that despite the bad things that are going on, that he can call out to God. Look at verse 4. There are three references to calling to God in this particular psalm. Verse 4, Psalm 116, then called I upon the name of Jehovah. O Jehovah, I beseech thee, deliver my soul. And it goes on. Now, look down at verse 13. I'm just picking up the references to calling on the name of Jehovah. I will take the cup of salvation and call upon the name of Jehovah. And go down to verse 17. I will offer to thee the sacrifice of thanksgiving and will call upon the name of Jehovah. And this particular psalm, again, the point is that Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 7 says that God is near to those who call upon him. And over in text, it says that when people called out to God, that separation was closed, that God moved on their behalf. And this particular study is about how can we, in our day, draw near to God. Now, look, I want to talk about a couple other things related to bringing God close and seeing who is God, with whom is God close. Go with me to Psalm 34, 17. The righteous cried, and Jehovah heard, and delivered them out of all their trouble. Psalm 34, 17. Jehovah is near unto them that are of a broken heart, and save such as are of a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but Jehovah delivers them out of them all. So Jehovah is near to those who call upon him, and Jehovah is near to those of a broken heart and a contrite spirit. I want you to get how we are to draw near to God. Now go with me to Psalm 51. Psalm 51, you'll recall that this psalm was written by David after the matter of Bathsheba, and beginning in verse 15. Psalm 51, 15. O Lord, open thou my lips, and my mouth shall flow forth thy praise, for you delight not in sacrifice, else would I give it. You have no pleasure in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. Now, here we go. Remember the Torah portion. If you only had Leviticus and Numbers, if you only had this week's Torah portion, the only way you would know to draw near to God is through a korban, which is the thing which draws you near. But thank God we have Deuteronomy and these wonderful psalms, because they express how it is that we are to draw near unto God without sacrifice. David gets this. David makes it very clear that he understands that the whole point has never been sacrifices. You know, it says right here, you have no pleasure, no delight in sacrifice, or he would give it. David could easily give it, but he says you don't even desire that. You have no pleasure in burnt offering. And then he says this powerful point. The sacrifices of God, that which draws a person near to God, is a broken spirit and a contrite heart. It doesn't get any plainer than this. Now look, go with me to Psalm 4. Go with me to Psalm 4. And let's see, Psalm 4, 3. But know that Jehovah has set apart for himself him that is godly. Jehovah will hear when I call unto him. Stand in awe and sin not. Commune with your own heart upon your bed and be still. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in Jehovah. Again, the same idea. Go with me to Isaiah 61. Isaiah 61. I want to develop a little bit further this idea of a broken heart. Isaiah 61, the Spirit of the Lord, Jehovah, the Ruach Adonai Yehovah is upon me, because Jehovah has anointed me to preach good tidings unto the poor. He sent me to bind up the broken of heart, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to them that are bound, to proclaim the year of Jehovah's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort those who mourn. And it goes on. But the idea is that God is drawing near to those who draw near to him with a brokenness and a contrition that others don't have. There is a requisite, and that is a brokenness. Now, look with me to Isaiah 66, Isaiah 66, beginning on verse 1. Thus saith Jehovah, heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. What manner of house will you build unto me, and what place shall be my rest? All these things has my hand made, and so all these things came to be, saith Jehovah. But to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and that trembles at my word. Now that matches what we're reading in Psalm 34 and Psalm 51 and Isaiah 61. Listen to this, verse 3, Isaiah 61. He that kills an ox is as he that slays a man. He that sacrifices a lamb is he that breaks a dog's neck. He that offers an oblation as he that offers swine's blood. He that burns frankincense is he that blesses an idol. Yea, they have chosen their own ways, and their soul delights in their abominations. I will also choose their delusions and bring their fears upon them, because when I called, none did answer. When I spoke, they did not hear, but they did that which was evil in my eyes and chose that wherein I delighted not. What does God delight in? A broken spirit, a contrite heart, calling out to him. That's what God wants. Look with me to Psalm 145. Psalm 145, please. And verse 18. Jehovah is near unto all that call upon him, to all that call upon him in truth. One of my favorite passages. Jehovah is near unto all that call upon him, to all that call upon him in truth. In other words, this plan is for the world. This calling people to call out to Jehovah is rooted in the text of the Hebrew Bible. One cannot read Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9, Joel chapter 2, verse 32, or 3, 5 in Hebrew, if you prefer. You cannot read these without recognizing that the whole point is that humanity turns to the one God. The Jewish people are called to be near to God and to set that example. And at times in history, they've done that, and at times in history, they've not done that. That does not take away the whole point. The Bible begins on a universal scale. It's global. It involves humanity. It doesn't start in Exodus 12. The Bible begins in Genesis chapter 1. And because of that, we have to think universally. And because of that, the prophets of old took their message to the nations of the world. They didn't just go to the people of Israel. Think about it. Jonah didn't want to do it, but he went to the people of Nineveh, and he proclaimed a message, and they turned in sackcloth and ashes and repented, and God took away that which had been decreed against them. And God, Jehovah, can do the same today because the plan has not changed. The ultimate goal and meaning of history is that from sea to shining sea, that they shall all know Jehovah, from the least of them to the greatest. All the people of the earth, Psalm chapter 22, verse 26, says that all the people of the earth will turn towards the one true God. Isaiah 45, 21, and other passages says, turn to me, all the ends of the earth, and be saved. And listen to me, we can turn to Jehovah now. No matter who you are, or where you are, God hears those prayers. Read 1 Kings chapter 8, the dedication of the house in Solomon's time. Solomon makes it very clear, and God says, I agree with your words. that anyone who calls out to Jehovah in their time, that draws near to him, he'll hear it. See, people have forgotten this. Look, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. If God desired the slaughter of animals, we should do that. It says that he doesn't desire that over and over. That's for another class. I've taught on that many times. But what draws us near to God is a turning towards Jehovah with a pure heart, a contrite brokenness. Take with you words, said the prophet Hosea in return. Let me tell you this, words alone won't do the trick. I've got a whole shelf of prayer books. And if I sit down and just begin to read those prayers, and if I don't somehow connect with those words and mean it from my inside, which is also tied to our root of drawing near, there's no connection. Look at this. Go with me. Let me make this point. Go with me to Jeremiah chapter 12. Jeremiah 12 and okay, verse 1, Jeremiah 12, 1. Righteous art thou, Jehovah. When I contend with thee, yet would I reason the cause with thee. Wherefore doth the way of the wicked prosper? Wherefore are they at ease that deal very treacherously? You've planted them, yea, they have taken root. They grow, yea, they bring forth fruit. You are near in their mouth, but far from their heart. Kuruvata, kuruvatuta. Near are you in their mouth, but their heart is far. See, there are a group of people who draw near to God with the mouth, but not with the heart. And that doesn't work. Go with me to Isaiah 29. Isaiah 29, verse 13. And the Lord said, for as much as this people draw near unto me, and with their mouth and with their lip do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear of me is a commandment of men which was taught to them. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder, and the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. Listen to me. If a person seeks to draw near unto God with their mouth only, with their lips only, won't work. If our mouth is near and our heart is far, so what I'm trying to say today is that we must return. We must draw near, but it must be with both. Go with me to Isaiah 55. Isaiah 55, verse 6. Seek ye Jehovah while he may be found. Call ye upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto Jehovah, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith Jehovah. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Look. The world, our world, finds itself today in trying times. People feel isolated and alone. History is replete with similar instances. A plague, a pestilence, if you will, is affecting our world today. That's happened before. A plague or pestilence or disease that seems to be spread by touch. That has happened before. People are practicing hygiene and quarantine the same today as can be shown from the biblical text. And people called out to God in ancient times. Pinchas is an example of one who prayed, stood up and prayed on behalf of the people to stay the plague, and it worked. The question is that possible today? Could it still work? Could we not come together and call out to the one true God with a humbleness and a contrition? And could the same result take place? Let us all draw near to God with our inward parts, and perhaps He will hear us, perhaps He will heal us, and perhaps one day people will say about our people in our time that it was then that people began to call again on the name of Jehovah. God bless you. Be safe. Be healthy. And we'll be back next week.